Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, December 27th, and this is our special year-end news roundup. Today we're going to look back at the year in the news and discuss some of the top local stories of 2019. Joining me in the studio from the Cape Cod Times is Ethan Genter. Good morning, Ethan.
Good morning, Steve.
And also with us is WCAI Sarah Mises-Tan. Hi, Sarah.
Good morning, Steve.
And a little later in the program, we'll be joined by WCAI's environmental reporter, Eve Zuckoff, to discuss the year's top climate-related stories. And now a look at some of the stories from the past year. Top story of 2019, here we go. Until this year, the Cape had seen just three tornadoes in its history. This year, we equaled that number all in a day with three tornadoes striking the Cape on Tuesday, July 23rd. Both of you reported on this. I want to start with kind of how it all came about because it happened so quickly. And for us in Woods Hole, the first thing that we, when we realized something had really happened, was there was a report about a hotel in Yarmouth.
Yeah, for us, I think it had just been, we were kind of watching the weather because I know there had been a couple different tornado warnings and they hadn't necessarily materialized into anything. I had just been on Twitter, I remember, watching what was going on and then saw some posts suddenly about the Cape Sands Inn and the roof getting blown off. And I think that's when we made the call to just send me out and take a look.
Yeah, I mean, that was kind of the iconic image of this storm was just this. Everyone's seen the video, but if not, the roof really just kind of peels right off. And there's people inside of there who are like, they're on vacation. They've never seen a tornado before. They're not expecting tornadoes when you're on Cape Cod. And they're kind of sitting in bathtubs or running, trying to get down to the first floor. And then, I mean, that's not a great way to start your vacation. But, so we had three of them, like Steve said, South Yarmouth, West Yarmouth, and Harwich.
It took a little while even for us to get to that information because that first day, everybody assumed it was one tornado that had kind of come up off of the water and torn through the South Yarmouth and then went up through Harwich. And a little bit later, the National Weather Service started to pull apart the data and suggest that there were two and then maybe three.
And then eventually, yeah, they confirmed three after kind of they were approached by, I think, meteorologists and some residents. They kind of compiled all this information and then they're like, oh, well, we had three tornadoes. But yeah, it was pretty wild.
Sarah, yeah. You went out there to the hotel as soon as we kind of figured out what was there was something going on. We sent you out and tell us a little bit of what you remember about that scene there.
Yeah. You know, I think a lot of people were very surprised. I think there was maybe even some thought on Twitter that maybe it hadn't actually happened. And so I remember going out and saying like, oh, OK, maybe we'll have like part of the roof off or something. And in fact, the entire roof, as Ethan said, was just behind the hotel. It had just totally been torn off. A lot of people, thankfully, I think it hit at a very opportune time. If a tornado can hit at an opportune time, it was the height of summer, of course. But it was kind of, I think I remember like late morning or something. And most people were actually out for the day already. And so there were a lot of people who were gathered outside, a lot of hotel guests who had heard that something had happened to their hotel and they came back to look. But thankfully, I don't think that a lot of people were actually inside the hotel and no one sustained any injuries, which is really fortunate.
Really amazing for a midsummer event when the Cape is just bursting with people. This happened and there was no deaths and not really any reported major injuries out of this. It's almost hard to believe how that could happen. Dennisport, I know the Dennis fire chief, I remember him saying that it looked like a war zone when it went through there. And Ethan, Harwich was just had trees scattered everywhere. You went out and did some reporting there.
Yeah, Harwich was definitely the hardest hit town on the Cape. And I mean, we drove around Harwich basically all day the next day and then the next day. But I mean, there was just trees everywhere. I mean, you tried to go to one place and then you're like, all right, we got to take a detour. And you're just taking detours all over the town. And kind of, you really started to get an understanding of this. We went to the Harwich dump. And so you imagine there's got to clean up all these trees. So a lot of the towns ended up waiving fees for disposal of debris and stuff. But, I mean, there was just this, it was over 15 feet high, tall pile of trees. And so people would come in, they'd drag their brush, and then kind of a front-end loader would just push it all into this big pile. And eventually, I mean, they were going to get a stump grinder and kind of mulch it down. I mean, it was just a fantastic sight to see.
They said this was an EF1 hurricane, which I guess is kind of the lower end of the scale, but it certainly made its impact here. National Guard came to Dennis to help clean up, and And it did happen in the middle of the summer. This had an impact on a lot of businesses that, you know, they're geared up for summer to be their time to make their money that they need to make for the year. And here it took businesses out of line, knocked out a lot of power for a lot of businesses. And there was a moment there where people were wondering how we were going to cope with this happening in the middle of the tourist season.
Yeah. But, you know, I think what was kind of interesting to note is that they did seek federal aid for these damages. But at the end of the day, I think they determined that there just was not that threshold of damage needed to get federal aid. But they did still get state aid, which is important to note. But yeah, I think it was kind of very particular instances.
Yeah. So for federal aid, it needs to be damaged like public property. And the damage threshold, it's kind of this weird algorithm for different areas of the country. But for our area, the threshold to get disaster aid was $9.6 million.
Mm-hmm.
And like you said, Steve, there was no super damage. And besides, I mean, the Cape Sands Inn, but it had to be to public property. So like a town hall had to basically cave in. I think we only ended up getting $3.7 million in estimated damages to public property. So, I mean, we're a far cry off. And even the state aid was questionable at one point whether that was going to come through.
That only came through in the last couple of weeks with the passage of the supplemental budget.
Absolutely. And that supplemental budget was kind of held up up in the state house and barely made the deadline. So, but yeah, there was the Baker administration did set aside small business loans for businesses. I mean, we're talking to restaurants who had to throw out all of their food.
That's right. Directly in the wake of the tornado, there was that little package of loans that came down. And also to promote tourism again, because they wanted people to be sure that they knew that the Cape was open for business.
Yeah, the lieutenant governor came down. They kind of stumped, and DeLeo was down. I mean, a lot of officials ended up coming down, which is kind of weird for the way the budget went. But
before we leave it, one of the things about the story that was, I think, unique for us in this newsroom was there were people saying this is as bad as the damage of Hurricane Bob. Say, if you were out where this happened, but in other parts of the Cape, the day after you'd be driving around, you had no idea this was happening. It was so localized, as opposed to a hurricane that sweeps across the whole region and nobody misses the fact that it came ashore.
Yeah, I think that's kind of the interesting thing about these tornadoes and where the damage is like very, or at least driving through what I saw, it seemed the damage was very, very particular in very, very specific spots because it's a tornado, so it's going to touch down in a specific spot. It's going to damage that area, but unlike a hurricane, it's not really going to be like a swath of damage. It was more like very particular, precise areas. And then you could drive through another road or another part of that town or the town next door, and it would look totally fine, or they would be without power.
There wouldn't even be a blade of grass like out of touch. Like if you went to certain parts of Brewster, you wouldn't even have known that Harwich. I mean, even just other parts of Harwich, you wouldn't even know that the downtown got blasted. It was we don't deal with tornadoes. So, I mean, that's the thing is almost everyone's like, how'd you do in the hurricane? And then you're like, wait, sorry, tornado, because we don't deal with tornadoes. So it was very interesting.
Yeah. As news people, I thought it was a challenge to cover because that damage was so localized, and yet it was such a big event. And you could look the other way and not see any evidence of it. Next story, I want to talk about a major story for the region, but one that happened very quietly, outwardly anyway. Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station closed for good. This happened on May 31st. You know, the tornadoes, like we say, they happened without warning. This, by contrast, was a long time coming. And in the end, I don't think anyone would have noticed it happened if it hadn't been announced. As the year started, there were still a lot of questions around this, even fears that it might not happen for the advocates who had been pressing for this for a long time. There's a lot of backstory here. Maybe, Sarah, you can start us off by tell us about, like, you reported on this a lot. You visited the nuclear plant. You got a tour inside. You stood on top of the reactor. And you can tell us a little bit about the plant itself and some of the worries that it had provoked, particularly for folks living on the Cape.
Sure. Yeah, definitely. First of all, standing on top of the reactor, probably one of the highlights of my reporting trips this year on a personal note. But yeah, this Pilgrim Nuclear was the closest operating nuclear power plant to the Cape. It'd been running since the 1970s, but it's long been plagued with problems and concerns about the health of the surrounding community. It's had a couple of major shutdowns, particularly in the 1980s. It closed for maybe about 10 years and then it reopened again. And it was chosen to officially decommission due to aging infrastructure and rising costs of safely maintaining nuclear equipment a couple years back, I believe, in 2015, I want to say. And of course, it was it had been one of the worst ranked nuclear reactors in terms of safety in the entire country, according to the federal government.
Long history of problems at this plant and frequent unexpected shutdowns in order to address equipment. Long history of the community being very concerned about this. And then in March of this year, the plant was reclassified, actually. It had been, in, as you say, in this category of being close as you can get to mandatory shutdown. I think it was, what did they call that, Category 4?
Yeah, category.
And then it was kind of abruptly reclassified to the category that requires the least oversight. And I think that brought out a lot of outcry from people who have been watching this story.
Yeah, kind of in the very last hours of its lifetime here, it got recategorized to the lowest level category of safety, normal.
Or of oversight, lowest level category of oversight, right?
Yes, sorry. It's kind of confusing to talk about, but yeah. Essentially it got recategorized as a normal functioning power plant in the very last couple months of operation. Officials said that this was because a lot of the safety issues that had been raised over the last few years had been addressed in full. But of course, a lot of advocates were pretty dubious that this plant could have moved from the worst ranked category to the best ranked category in just a matter of a couple of years. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the federal agency that oversees these types of power plants, told me that this was actually fairly normal practice, that they write a list of things for the worst performing power plants, and if they can address all of those safety needs, they'll move them back into the normal performing category.
I think a lot of people saw this maybe as being tied to the closing of the plant and the possible sale of the plant.
Yeah, I don't think a plant's ever closed in Category 4. So, I mean, a lot of people are like, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, they are just working for the industry. This is a lot of opponents have said they're just going along with whatever they say. It's kind of funny that after Nor'easters, decades of Nor'easters, protests, lawsuits, what finally shuts Pilgrim down is the energy market and an aging plant, basically.
Yeah, just this getting to be such an older plant that to do anything more with it wouldn't be cost effective, it sounded like. And then as we got into the later spring, a lot of attention turned on the proposed sale of the plant to this outside company, Holtec, for decommissioning. And really people started to take a look at this company, Holtec, and who they are and what kind of promises they were going into this sale with, and a lot of skepticism there.
Yeah, so Holtec had been coming in. They were saying that they were experts in decommissioning, and that is partially true. They have decommissioned, they have provided the materials for other nuclear plants to decommission. They're typically, they provide things like dry cask storage, and sometimes they'll be brought on as consultants. And when a nuclear plant decides to close down, there is a lot of procedure there that, you know, the owners of Entergy just said they were not experts in. However, Holtec has not ever actually fully decommissioned a plant in the way that they are proposing to do.
This has got to be a first time, right?
Yes.
Do you want it to be on your nuclear plant? That's what I think a lot of the critics were pointing to.
Yeah, and there was a lot of concern that the amount of money that's in the decommissioning fund for Pilgrim right now is not enough to cover the total cost of decommissioning. There were a lot of questions about who's going to eventually get stuck with that bill if the cost of decommissioning does go over what's available in the fund. And of course, Holtec has not had the greatest track record in terms of its financials. And I think there was a lot of concern that Holtec would essentially just stick the town of Plymouth with that bill.
And then in August, it was announced that this sale was going through. This was it. Holtec got it. And there was a big outcry again from a lot of the critics saying that they were never given a fair opportunity to participate in this discussion. Maura Healey, the state's attorney general, really pushing back here, saying that the sale should not have been approved without addressing these concerns.
Yeah, you know, Holtec really refused to sit down at the table and negotiate with the town of Plymouth any of their terms. The town of Plymouth had really been concerned about, A, getting stuck with a bill, B, they really want to rehabilitate the land that the power plant sits on, then they want to make sure that that gets turned back over to the town in a state that would be safe for it to be reused as a park or for residential properties. And Holtec did not agree to any of those things. I think a lot of people, including the Citizens Advisory Board, were really trying to put some pressure on Holtec to negotiate. And in the end, that just didn't happen.
And now that the plant is closed and that nuclear fuel is being put into dry cask storage, it's a long process, there's still concerns. So much to be concerned about with this nuclear waste essentially being on site.
Yeah, certainly. I think there is, of course, that overarching concern. Where will that nuclear waste go? The federal government does not have an answer to that. And so for the time being, I think some advocates are pretty upset that Plymouth is essentially becoming a de facto nuclear waste site. I think there's concern about the degradation of the dry cask storage units that house the nuclear fuel rods. There have been some concerns about cracks in them. And of course, you don't really want that nuclear material leaking out at any point. And they're supposed to sit there for 50 plus years.
Right now, there's no place to take nuclear fuel. It can't leave the site because there's nowhere else to go.
Yeah.
And then I guess the other thing I would just point to here in this story is that with Pilgrim closing, there were some questions about the grid, but it turns out the grid is pretty resilient. This is the power grid that supplies the entire region. What happens as Pilgrim is taken out of that picture?
Sure, yeah. So one piece of good news is that, yes, thankfully, the way the New England grid works is that no one region receives power directly from their closest power plant. And so Pilgrim closing is not going to impact the way that the Cape gets energy or the amount of energy that the Cape gets. Instead, the way the ISO, which is the company that owns the New England grid, works is that all power plants will feed their energy up to the grid owners, and then it's redistributed down to different regions depending on demand. Pilgrim had a fairly variable energy output given the number of times it had to shut down or partially shut down in its history, particularly in the last few years. And even when it operates at capacity, it produced about 700 megawatts of energy. So the grid will easily be able to make up for this hole, most likely by just buying more power from other power plants in the region or buying hydropower from Canada. And potentially, of course, in the future, there's the hope that offshore wind farms will be able to fill that as well.
The next top story of 2019 is big because really it didn't happen. This is the sharks off our coast. 2018 saw the first fatal shark attack on record on Cape Cod after a long increase in the number of great whites in our waters. A lot of people feared a repeat fatal attack this year, and thankfully no shark attack happened. Certainly, there was no end of talk about the possibility and what could be done to make the water safer. In fact, 2019 started with the towns talking about joining together to fund a plan to look at technologies, which is something that they did do, and they enlisted this consultant, the Woods Hole Group, to put together a plan.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so it's kind of that instance where you're at a dangerous intersection, and you know it's kind of dangerous, so you kind of pay attention a little more, and so accidents actually don't happen there as much. People went into the water, and I think even some lifeguards had mentioned this to us, is when they used to have to tell people to come in, you're too far out, they never had to do that this year, really, because people kind of knew you don't go past that break line anymore. So yeah, I think people were kind of the culture had shifted a little bit. It's not just fun and sun anymore on the beach. You do have to think twice when you're going in.
I think you're right that 2019 really did mark the big turning point in thinking about interacting with the water around Cape Cod. And I can't imagine anybody went swimming this year without thinking about somewhere in their mind about what had happened with the boogie boarder last year in 2018.
Yeah, and I think, I guess if you had gone out to some of those Outer Cape beaches, you may have noticed a couple new things. Things like a lot of lifeguards patrolling on ATVs with first aid kits and stop the bleed kits. There were stop the bleed kits at the entrance of a lot of these beaches, call boxes, which were something that wasn't there before, and a lot of large signage warning about the very real danger of great white shark attacks.
There were concerns as we headed towards the summer that towns weren't doing enough or they weren't being proactive enough. You just listed some of the things that towns felt like they could do. I think education seemed to be one of the things that towns focused on as being something that they could get to doing right away.
Yeah, if you go to any of those Atlantic-facing Outer Cape beaches, you'll see that big sign that says, Be Shark Smart. You'll see the big purple flags. I mean, one of the things that was kind of interesting was it's kind of the liability issue. If you put things and make people feel like they're safe, is that an issue? Could you be on the hook if something happens? Which is something that a lot of Outer Cape towns had to think about.
I think there was a moment when the Wellfleet town council sort of advised the town not to investigate too many strategies to try to create a protected zone, because they couldn't. There is liability around that. You couldn't really guarantee people's safety.
Yeah, it was talk about putting buoys out and kind of, are these buoys actually going to help? That was kind of a question.
Right.
And then it's, if you put these out and make people feel safe, it's kind of like if you touch that boat that's sitting on the breakwater, it's your problem now. So it was kind of one of those instances.
Yeah. And I think a lot of towns or a lot of people really wanted things like drones or, yeah, like shark detection buoys or nets or some sort of like, I've heard something about like a buzzer or something that make a noise that would deter sharks.
Yeah, so there's this supposed electromagnetic kind of, some surfers believe they kind of wear this thing that gives out kind of a pulse and it kind of deters sharks. A lot of people started coming out of the weeds and offering technologies that would, I mean, was it striped swimsuits, I think, was another thing. I mean, so there's all these kind of different things that people started to wonder, and we're still kind of trying to figure out what actually works. Sharks are such an unknown, mysterious creature still to us.
Well, this brings me back to how I started the segment talking about the Woods Hole Group study, because in the end, these Outer Cape towns all got together along with the National Seashore and helped put together this study. They hired the Woods Hole Group to look at the technologies that are available right now that could be deployed as a deterrent or safety against the sharks. And when the study finally came out, I think a lot of people were putting a lot of hope into this. And at first, it seemed kind of crazy that it wasn't going to come out until the end of the summer. And then it did, you know, people sort of got their heads around that because they wanted the summer to look at this. It came out. And when it came out, I think a lot of people were scratching their heads at what it had to say.
Yeah, in the end, the report didn't really say anything new. It was $50,000, I want to say, to compile the report. And in the end, it kind of just said education was the best way to prevent a shark attack. And they were kind of, they said the jury was out with all these other solutions that came to like
all
technological.
Those other,
no
yeah.
silver bullet, I think, yeah. is the, right. the three words that can sum it up.
Yeah.
It did see, as we talked about, the mind shift about going into the water for people around here. We also saw a little bit of a mind shift around the tourism with sharks and how they were marketed. They're not necessarily a cute novelty anymore. I know that Chatham had their Sharks in the Park art event they used to have each year, and this year they kind of changed that. They didn't want to be doing that anymore.
We even saw stores kind of shift the cutesy shirts that you would see. Like, I know places used to have shirts that would say, have a shark on them and say, nice to eat you.
Right.
Those started to kind of get pulled as this is kind of not a cute thing as much anymore.
This is our special year-end news roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us is WCAI Sarah Mises-Tan and Ethan Genter from the Cape Cod Times. We'll have more in a moment. Welcome back. This is our special year-end news roundup. On the Point, we're discussing the top local news stories of 2019. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Ethan Genter. And also with us is WCAI's Sarah Mises-Tan. When 2019 started, a lot of us believed it would bring the beginning of the offshore wind industry in a very practical sense. But here we are, the end of 2019, still waiting for ground to be broken. Let's talk a little bit about this in Vineyard Wind. And in fact, looking back on this now, and when 2019 started, we were going through that partial government shutdown. And there was a lot of concern about how delays from the permitting might force the Vineyard Wind up against a timeline at the end of the year. And Vineyard Wind kept saying, no, it's going to work. The partial government shutdown isn't the big problem. Don't worry about it. And in the end, you know, how little we knew, that wasn't the big problem to worry about.
Yeah. In fact, I suppose in the end, they were right. The government shutdown was not the problem at all. I think that 2018 was a really good year in terms of offshore wind gaining momentum. I think it was a really good year for Vineyard Wind. They won their contract with the state. They put out a much lower rate for what they might be charging energy users for offshore wind. That was a surprise. I think we started 2019 with a whole lot of hope around the offshore wind farm coming up and being able to break ground at the end of 2019. In the end, I don't know if you want me to get into this now, but they hit some federal hurdles, and the federal government essentially pumped the brakes around August and said, wait, like this is moving too fast for us. We're going to need to reevaluate some things. And pretty much stop
and
things.
Really shoved the whole project into limbo, where it's still sitting now.
Yeah, I think in the background of all of this hope from 2018 going into early 2019, there was a lot of concerns being raised by fishing groups, particularly the midwater trawlers out of Rhode Island. They were really worried about their squid fishery in the area being affected. And I think they'd been kind of making some rumbling, and the federal government heard them. They said that, you know, with so many offshore wind farms coming up in this area, we really can't go forward and permit our first one before we actually really look at the effects that offshore wind farms can have on fisheries.
And there's an interesting dynamic here, because that's the federal government saying, slow down, hold on. But the state is still pushing, it seems like, with a lot of energy to make sure that offshore wind happens, and happens first if they can make it happen here out of Massachusetts. And that includes, they permitted a second offshore wind farm to happen now.
Yeah, I think Massachusetts has a lot riding on the offshore wind industry coming to Massachusetts. Obviously, there's a huge economic gain that would come with them just being first in the water. They're really hoping that the Port of New Bedford can become a serious offshore wind port for the nation. So I think, and that coupled with the fact that Massachusetts does not have a whole lot of renewable resources within the state right now. And so, you know, we buy a lot of our power from outside, like from Canada. And so it'd be great to be able to generate all of this just off our shores.
And getting first into the industry means that as it builds up down the rest of the East Coast, which seems like that's the direction it would head, you'd be able to supply those people with technology and workers, and just be kind of the hub that people are looking toward as having done it first.
Yes. And a lot of other states have followed since Massachusetts permitted Vineyard Wind in 2018. And so I think the state is kind of trying to maintain its lead.
Mm. I mean, one of the interesting things is when a new industry like this pops up, there's no one who's done this before. So we're kind of going through, kind of seeing how to get all this. Mass Maritime, the college up over in Buzzards Bay, just opened a new facility to kind of teach and train people in this kind of work. I think they're even going to have kind of, it's going to be added into their curriculum. I mean, I think one of the things to note is we should probably learn the lessons from Cape Wind, the wind project that was going to be off of in the Sound in Nantucket. That was a project that at the beginning everyone thought this is going to work, and then it eventually hit roadblock after roadblock after roadblock until it died, only a couple of years ago. So I think it's a similar thing here, where you kind of see Vineyard Wind starts out with a lot of momentum, and now we're starting to see kind of the hurdles. But obviously there are differences. Fishermen and the federal government seem to be the big proponents, even though some of the fishermen stuff with Rhode Island has started to clear.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think it's interesting to note that actually I thought that a lot of the hope behind this Vineyard Wind project was that the federal government had pre-selected this area to have a wind farm on. And so there was a lot of thought from offshore wind industry experts that this area would not run into the same hurdles that Cape Wind ran into, just because supposedly it had already been okayed by the federal government and they had already determined that this was an okay spot to put it. And so it's interesting to kind of see things come back and for them to say, oh, wait, well, we said it was okay, but maybe not.
And I think that there is, at least within the wind industry, I mean, there's a sense that this is where things are going, that offshore wind is too big to really get all the way in the front of right now and stop it, that it's going to happen along the East Coast. And the federal government is just trying to make sure it rolls out in a way that kind of makes as much sense as possible for something that nobody's ever done before, at least off the coast of the United States. And then there's also a little bit of a sense that the administration right now is not in as much behind renewables as a different federal administration might be. And that might be part of this discussion, too.
Yeah, you know, a lot of our experts that I've spoken with have really shied away from getting too political. But certainly, yes, that is definitely something to consider, that we're under an administration that may be a little more friendly towards gas.
Towards petroleum. The bridges on and off the Cape, another big story. It seemed this year the discussion of the condition of the bridges and the effort to replace them really reached a new level of consensus. And I think this has been a topic for so long, but in May, the Department of Transportation, Massachusetts, came out with a report looking at how a new set of bridges would connect to the roads around here and really advocating for a replacement of the bridges.
Yeah, it was kind of interesting because the bridges are the property of the federal government. So the state has no say over what really happens there. But they came out with a study while the federal government was also had an ongoing study on the bridges, and they kind of came out and said, these should be replaced. Their study really was to look at the lead-up roads and the roads surrounding the bridges to try and smooth that out, but all of their suggestions were all predicated on the replacement of the bridges and bigger, wider bridges. I think the state came out, and it seemed like they were kind of trying to put a little pressure on the federal government to let's get your study moving along.
The Cape Cod Chamber has been really vocal around this as well, saying that this is just so important to the region to address the bridges and not have them be shutting down for repairs every couple of years. And it's just a big impact on the health of the region.
Certainly, yeah. I think, the bridges are pretty much the only way you can get on and off the Cape. I know people have raised these concerns in relation to something happening potentially at Pilgrim Nuclear, that there might be a real disaster in just evacuating people off of those bridges. And I know that a lot of people have kind of talked potential alternatives to, putting something in place there. I know some people have mentioned maybe building bridges next to those current bridges.
Or a third bridge.
A third bridge, yeah.
So the federal delegation from Massachusetts had a bill designating the bridges as an evacuation route. I think they called it the escape bill. And that was intended to try to force the feds towards looking at this and eventually putting some money into it. Because as you said, Ethan, the bridges really are under they're controlled by the Army Corps of Engineers, the federal government, who came out with their own report then in the fall.
Correct, yeah. So that escape bill was actually a refiling of a bill that kind of withered on the vine in previous years. And that bill will put money, if approved, towards evacuation routes. And it seems like it's kind of tailored. Everything in there is kind of tailored to what the Cape Bridge is like. It has to do with population, if it's the only way in and out and stuff like that. But yeah, I mean, obviously, so then in, I think it was October, the Army Corps of Engineers on a Thursday night said, here you go. Here is the study we've been waiting years for. And they had told us it was coming out told me it was going to be coming out. It wasn't a super surprise. The Army Corps had said before they're leaning towards replacement, but this was kind of the first declaration where they say, we're looking at replacing the bridges. They would be right next to where the current ones are in their estimation. Still a lot of things to figure out, but they would be wider, extra lanes, which is what people kind of had asked for.
This was a draft study, as you say, and it's still in that stage. But one of the things I was enlightening about it was that it had images of what new bridges could look like. I mean, it really spelled it out here. The two through lanes in each going each way, plus then an auxiliary lane to get on and off, plus a 10-foot shoulder, and then space for bike and pedestrian path. And big, big bridges is kind of what they're detailing compared to our narrow little two lanes in each way bridges now.
Yeah, so the current ones were built in the 30s. As everyone who goes over them, you can see it says 33 to 35 right on them. And you can imagine they were built for cars from the 30s, which are not similar to the hunking SUVs that we drive nowadays. So right now, the bridges are 2 feet under what our current roadway standards are. Everyone knows that when you drive...
Each lane width is 2 foot under.
Yeah, so everyone knows when you drive, you have to either pick which lane you want. Do you want the one next to that massive cement block that is the sidewalk that is kind of scary to walk over? Or do you want to be inches away from an oncoming vehicle where, God forbid, something happens, they're coming right at you?
Yeah. This is going to be a big project if it happens. It's going to be a $1 billion project.
It would be estimated
to replace both bridges.
To replace both is estimated at about $1 billion. This would be the biggest project, I think, in the Cape's recent memory. So the Army Corps is expected to make a decision. They're supposed to finalize the report in February. Then they're expected to make a final decision on replacement in the spring. And then design work starts, but construction could start as early as 2025, which you think between now and then, I mean, we're talking about Vineyard Wind. I mean, think of how many roadblocks could come in there. Mm. And one of the big ones is financing. Like you said, $1 billion is a lot. That's about 20% of the Army Corps' annual budget. So just imagine having to dedicate that much money to a single project where they oversee the entire country.
Yeah.
I remember kind of seeing this report and feeling like, oh, like great kind of pie in the sky idea. I mean, it's good to have the report out there, but it didn't seem like we would really be seeing any changes anytime soon.
Well, something has to be addressed, and I think the Army Corps of Engineers in that report pointing to the fact that if they don't move this quickly, they're going to have to do more major work on the existing bridges, which is kind of throwing away maybe money, good money after bad, with the fact that they are just out of date and will just need perpetual upkeep.
So, yeah, rehabilitation of the bridges is expected to cost almost, if not slightly more, than building new bridges. And the Sagamore is due for a major overhaul in 2025. So I think they are. And, I mean, the Army Corps has paid lip service. Even if it's only lip service, they have said the head has met with the Massachusetts delegation. He has said in testimony that they're dedicated to looking at ways to get this done. So, I mean, they're saying all the right things. We'll see what actually happens. But
our next top story of 2019 is another story a bit similar to sharks in that it's about something that didn't happen, and this involves legalized marijuana. The state approved adult-use marijuana in 2016 by a ballot referendum. As 2019 ends, we still have no adult-use, that's recreational marijuana, store open on Cape Cod itself. But we do have word that one is coming. And this kind of makes us into a bracket because one opened in Wareham at the very end of 2018, December 2018. Now it looks like Cape's first store will open in 2020. And 2019 actually saw one open on Nantucket. So
if anything, the Cape is always late to trends. we're not usually on the breaking cusp of anything.
Yeah, I know. There was a lot of frustration from a number of, I guess, cannabis advocacy organizations where they were saying that they felt like the Cape's slowness to move on this legislation was really pushing business owners away or pushing entrepreneurs who had ideas that were related or would provide ancillary services to these retail organizations. They really felt like this was like a great economic opportunity for the Cape, and the Cape was hesitating.
A bit of a surprise in that some of the area, like only a handful of towns on the Cape actually approved to have adult use marijuana stores open, but some of them really wanted to embrace this, Provincetown being one of them. That's where it looks like this first shop is going to open early in January or toward the end of January.
Which isn't surprising for anyone who's been to Provincetown. Provincetown has no limit on alcohol licenses, and I think they have the highest alcohol license per capita in the state. Provincetown has said free market. If you want to open one up, you can. They do put limits. You have to be open year round. You can be closed for certain periods, but you have to basically be open year round. Around seven are hoping to come to town. And they're basically saying, go ahead, you can open. You may not survive, but if you want to try it, go ahead. But a lot of other towns are not taking that view. Only Brewster, Mashpee, and the Outer Cape basically allow marijuana, recreational.
And it's been a fraught journey for Brewster. You've covered a bunch of that, Ethan.
Yeah, Brewster and Bourne have kind of gone through the rigmarole. So Brewster passed a ban, but it was done as a general bylaw, and the town had already adopted zoning bylaws. And then the AG's office later came down and said, you can't overrule a zoning bylaw with a general bylaw. And so it kind of gets into wonky zoning rules. But basically, so Brewster has kind of gone through the rigmarole. Bourne as well. They ended up upholding their ban in Bourne. And there were plans for a recreational one out there. So yeah, it's kind of run the gamut in those two towns.
Well, it seems almost certain now that 2020 is going to bring a change in the landscape here.
Yeah, I think there is some hope that at least the opening of a Curaleaf out in Provincetown is going to perhaps show some of the other towns that may have been a little more on the fence or a little more hesitant to embrace retail marijuana that, in fact, it is just another storefront. It isn't going to bring about, I guess, all of the different fears that people have associated with marijuana coming to a town. I think advocates are hoping that they can just show that this shop can operate in a quiet fashion and not draw too much attention after that initial rush, and that we can all move on and see it as a good economic driver.
This is our special year-end news roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us is WCAI Sarah Mises-Tan and Ethan Genter from the Cape Cod Times. We'll have more in a moment. Welcome back. This is our special year-end news roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of 2019. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Ethan Genter. And with us also is WCAI's Sarah Mises-Tan. I want to do something a little different now. I want to ask you each about a story that you reported this year that stayed with you. This is not necessarily the biggest story of the year, but one that got you thinking or feeling a little more maybe than you expected. Ethan, let's start with you.
Yeah, so I think the one that kind of stuck with me the most was the graduation on Cuddy Hunk, the tiny little island off of Woods Hole here. So Cuddy Hunk has a one-room schoolhouse. I think it's the only one left in the state, and they had one student left, and it's the last student. And so her name's Gwen, and she graduated this year and is going to be going off island to go to high school. But it was a really big deal for the island to kind of see. There's only about 12 year-round residents out there, and to see their one child kind of go off off island and kind of into the sunset was really touching for everyone out there. And plus, they had a big name. Jenny Slate was the graduation speaker. Kind of a very touching moment and interesting to see how this little community kind of meshes.
And this story that happened on the small island down at the bottom of the Elizabeth Islands, it turned into a national story, in part because Jenny Slate was there.
But yeah, absolutely. I think kind of that kind of culmination of factors you have, it's kind of interesting, this little island, one student, one massive star speaker. It was talked to, Michael Strahan talked about it on the Good Morning show. I forget which one he's on. Yeah, it got into the New York Times. It was kind of all over. Yeah, it was kind of interesting.
But before you went to cover this, had you been out to Cuddy Hunk?
Yes, I've been there several times to cover other stuff.
Yeah, so it's such a small community, and as you say, to have their last student leaving the island for any foreseeable future, it's a big turning point for a lot of people there.
Yeah, and everybody. People say this a lot. Everybody knows everybody, but on Cuddy Hunk, that is actually true. There's no cars. Everyone drives around golf carts. There's a cop there only in the summer. If you literally walk up to the top of the hill and do a 360, you can see the whole island. Like it's such a tight-knit community, and it was really touching to see.
Sarah, how about you? What's a story that stayed with you that you reported this year?
Sure. So I know this isn't necessarily a news story, but one of the stories that's really stuck with me and that I'm particularly proud of having done this year was my story about Fall River's chow mein sandwich. As you probably know, Steve, being my editor, it was a story that kind of came out of a desire of mine to cover the Asian American communities here more. I feel they aren't often looked at very closely, and particularly in New England, their mark in the region isn't always acknowledged, despite the fact that today they are New England's fastest growing group of immigrants. And so, as you know, I'd kind of been circling the issue for a while in a bit of a frustrating way, trying to talk to Asian restaurant owners around here. And I guess, long story short, someone finally gave me some sort of tip. They asked if I'd ever been to the chow mein noodle factory in Fall River. They told me it'd been there for ages, and I kind of took the bait and immediately called up that noodle factory, and the story kind of came out from there. Essentially, I found that the noodle factory is the epicenter of a very particular Fall River food, if you haven't heard the story, that would not exist without Chinese immigrants, which is, of course, the chow mein sandwich. And people, of course, can just give that story a listen. But one thing I've been kind of trying to do in my reporting as a larger whole here is to acknowledge my strengths and weaknesses as a reporter. I'm Asian, if you haven't met me in person. And I've found that there are a lot of topics for me that are harder to get at because of how I look. But this was a topic that came so easily to me. And it made me feel good to be shining a light on this long-held Fall River tradition. Plus, come on, it's so much fun to report. The owners of this chow mein sandwich restaurant were incredibly kind. They're so excited to be getting some press. And, of course, even found that there is a song written about the sandwich, and I got to sample it as well. And our coverage actually got picked up by CNN afterwards, too. They went and profiled this tiny little restaurant.
And it was also picked up by NPR as a national story.
Yeah, we did do a story for National on it as well. I think it has a really wide appeal just because at the end of the day, it is kind of a story about just the American dream happening, and it's kind of a relic of an American immigration pattern happening. I would say that lots of people asked me what the chow mein sandwich tasted like, and I would say that it tastes like America.
Thank you for that. This is our special year-end news roundup. I'm Steve Junker. Joining us has been Ethan Genter from the Cape Cod Times. Ethan, thank you for coming in.
Thank you, Steve.
And WCAI's own Sarah Mizestan. Sarah, thank you.
Thanks so much.
This hour wouldn't be complete without talking about the year in climate change, especially its impacts locally. WCAI's own climate reporter Eve Zuckoff joins us for that. Eve, thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Steve.
What would you highlight as this year's number one climate change story for you?
In a word, teens. They've really been galvanized here locally, also globally, really, by 16-year-old Greta Thunberg, a Swedish activist, founder of Future for Fridays. You may have seen she made headlines recently as Time Magazine's Person of the Year. Of course, there are so many more youth climate activists, Jamie Margolin, Mari Kopany, Vic Barrett, Shutza Katz-Martinez. And back in September, they were really the face of global climate strikes. So there were more than 800 rallies organized in all 50 states. That trickled down here on the Cape. We counted here at CAI at least 9 strikes. And at many of them, kids were leading the way, or they were the focus of the action. You know, later, more recently, we saw the Youth Climate Action Summit, where 100 students from 10 schools across the Cape gathered to talk about climate change and come up with solutions for their own schools. You know, we've seen kids on the vineyard push plastic bottle bans. One kid said to me very nonchalantly, yeah, I see us being the generation who hopefully saves the world. And it's that kind of idealism that I've really seen across the Cape. I've met dozens of kids just like him.
So what do you think? Why are the youth so galvanized right now?
So I asked a local teacher about that question, and a big part of it is developmental. There's social interaction. There's community that's both on and off the phones, actually. But there's also this genuine understanding of the threats we face. And that's been reinforced by ownership. So it's this really interesting cycle, I think. And on the one hand, the media and other activists have been genuinely delighted and energized by the teen activism we've seen. And on the other hand, certain political figures have taken pains to criticize activists and their work. And so I think it's lit this fire. And these teens, they know they're being looked to. And also, they're responding to really serious reports, to really serious warnings from scientists. The UN's International Panel on Climate Change found in one report earlier this year that the Earth's oceans are getting hotter, higher, more acidic. Those phenomenons are accelerating. And also, another more recent and maybe more important report found that the gap between what needs to be done in the way of climate change mitigation and adaptation and what's actually happening is so profound. So there's this feeling of panic, crisis, emergency, which is, you know, how more than 11,000 scientists from around the world described climate change in a letter back in November. Kids hear that, they know that, and they're like, you know, okay, most climate solutions are really simple. Let's do something.
That first report you mentioned, the IPCC report, is one of many that point out the problems that sea level rise poses as a consequence of climate change. How has that played out here on the Cape?
Yeah, so sea level rise is the single greatest existential threat to the Cape in terms of climate change. The other one is major coastal storms. And on the Cape and Islands, we've seen, in response to that, a number of coastal action resiliency committees form in different towns. And they've really been tasked with assessing what the greatest vulnerabilities are in terms of coastal erosion and flooding. And this is part of a larger movement. Towns in Florida and Long Island have had to ask questions about their coastlines and whether retreat is necessary and what it would look like and how it would go. And in Falmouth, that's a conversation we've been having. You know, the future of Surf Drive has been called into question. The town is currently using a state grant to fund work by the Woods Hole Group, you know, a local engineering firm, to evaluate what can be done because the road floods and is washed over with sand so regularly. And the projections for the area are really bleak given the rate at which the sea is rising and how low-lying the area is. So our town, like many others across the country, is taking a really hard look at how to protect our assets.
That is WCAI's climate change reporter, Eve Zuckoff. Eve, I want to thank you for coming in on our year-end news roundup.
My pleasure. Thank you, Steve.
And that's our year-end news roundup. Thank you to Ethan Genter of the Cape Cod Times, and big thanks to WCAI's Sarah Mises-Tan. I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.